Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. And you know what I'm looking at? I'm looking at my Thanksgiving reflection because I'm broadcasting on Tuesday and Thanksgiving's on Thursday. And I just realized this is the second hour of the broadcast, which means you were getting this on Friday. Black Friday, no less. So I guess this would be Thanksgiving reflection in arrears for most people. Better late than never, okay? Actually, this particular Thanksgiving reflection is apologetics in nature. So I'm not talking about, you know, all the things you ought to be thankful to for God and all that. I mean, I think those things are things you're naturally going to be thinking about. In fact, I hope, did I say this is Stand to Reason? I'm Greg Kokel. I didn't say that yet. Okay. This is, and I am. I hope you're already thankful for things. Okay. I hope that you are thankful on a regular basis. You know, I've tried to make it a habit, and I'm not trying to wave my own flag because I'm not good at prayer. But I've tried to make it a habit to be thankful for particular things and starting out my prayer with that. By the way, that it's not that hard to be thankful for stuff. I think petitionary prayer is more laborious. So you're thinking about things that you want to God to do and take care of and whatever, and it just strikes me that that's more work. But when I'm, you know, driving to the office and I'm in my Ford F-150, my beautiful kind of red pickup truck, I'm thankful for that truck. My family calls it the bubble, you know, because you feel like you're in a bubble. You're in a big protected thing. I like that. And plus, I always keep it clean and take it to the car wash. And, okay, well, that's a material thing. Nevertheless, I'm thankful for it. Okay, thank you, Lord. I'm driving to the office this morning. It's, what, I leave at 7 in the morning. I go through Malibu Canyon, heading for the coast. Then I drive up the coast, and it's a beautiful ride. I never get tired of that canyon making that trip. I don't do it every day, but a couple times a week, maybe. Thank you, Lord. And thank you. I just kissed my daughter good morning while she was still sleeping. And thank you, Lord. And thank you for this. And I'm giving thanks, I guess, is relatively simple. And it's relatively easy if you want to get the prayer engines going, all right? Not only that, is I had a discipleship group in my home a number of years ago. Amy, were you in that group that we did this study on prayer in the New Testament? Was that you? Amy was in one of the groups. But I lose track of which group was which. But what one group, we just decided, let's assign out sections of the New Testament and let's read our section with an eye to isolating all the passages in the section that related to prayer. By the way, a lot of times the word prayer is not used, so you can't use a concordance. So when Paul says, for this reason I bow my knees before the Father, so that, okay, well then that is a prayer. And so that would be included. And what we did is we isolated all of the issues of prayer, and we made an outline of it. In fact, it's on our website. I think if you look at str.org and look up prayer in the New Testament, there's the outline of all the things that we learned with the references. And do you know what came up most often? Prayer of Thanksgiving. Prayer of Thanksgiving. That is, there were prayers giving thanks, and there were references saying we ought to give thanks, and those are prayers. So the thing that the New Testament has the most to say about regarding prayer is being thankful. All right? And that's why when you pray, if you start out saying, hey, thank you for this, thank you for that, thank you for the other thing, this is kind of a spirit lifter. You may be thanking for the awful things, too, that you're going through in the moment with an attitude of trust that God's going to turn the bad things to good things down the line. You know, Romans 8:28 kind of stuff. But nevertheless, it's a great way of getting started in the morning if you're at your home or driving or wherever you pray. Or any time, frankly, if you're thinking, oh, I'm not so much into this, all right, then just start thinking about things you could say thank you for. By the way, one thing that we did not find, having surveyed every single reference in the New Testament to prayer, is we never found any reference to listening prayer. Think about that for a moment. You can find like whole sections of books about listening prayer. That is, you pray to God and then you stop praying and you listen to see what God is talking to you about. Well, it's not in there. Why isn't it in there? Because it's not a New Testament discipline. I don't think it's a good idea. No, it's okay to be reflective on things that maybe you need to address and ideas you might have about what that is and what you read in Scripture that might apply and maybe changes you need to make. God works in all kinds of mysterious ways, but there's no reason biblically to stop talking and listen. And how many gazillion people say that it is? Isn't that strange that the Scripture never says that? Just something to chew on. But that's actually not my main thought. My main thought about Thanksgiving is not about giving thanks per se, which we've been talking about. My main thought about Thanksgiving is a kind of a hint that there is in gratitude about the existence of God. So I want you to think about this. It seems to me that there is no such thing, practically speaking, as gratitude, like just sitting there. That is, we never have gratitude in isolation. It's not like, well, I'm just grateful. It's always grateful or gratitude for something, right? Like my red F-150. And gratitude to. It's gratitude for and gratitude to. So I'm grateful for this, and who, to whom am I grateful? Oh, that's the kicker. People give us things. So I got a cake today that looked like my book, the new second edition of Tactics. Did you get it yet? Go get it. It's worth it. 40% new material. 6 new tactics. 5 new tactics. Double, almost double. Good stuff. There was a cake that I was grateful for. I didn't just come in like gratitude. No, there's a cake. I'm grateful for the cake, but I'm not grateful just for the cake. I am grateful to the one who gave the cake, right? I mean, that's not even complicated. That's not even profound. I tuned into this show to hear that. That's not profound. We are thankful for things, of course, and we are thankful to the ones who gave us things. We are thankful to the persons regarding the things we are thankful for. Okay, pretty simple, not controversial. Thankful to my parents for raising me a certain way, maybe. Thankful to the founders for creating a nation like ours, okay? Now, pretty basic. Now, with that in mind, do you realize that there are some things that we are thankful for that no human being is responsible for? What now? And when I say we're thankful for them, we have a sense inside of us that it's appropriate to be grateful regarding this thing. Maybe thankful, grateful I was born in the U.S. I mean, yes, I had parents, but the parents were not responsible for me being here. That wasn't just an accident. I mean, they were here, and they had a kid, and it was me. So if I'm grateful for being in the U.S., there's some other thing going on there, an act of, okay, watch this one, fasten your seatbelts, an act of providence. So here's what I'm getting at. I think most of us properly feel thankful for many things that no human has given to us, but it seems we have been given it nonetheless. So, who is the proper object of our gratitude in those cases? And all I'm suggesting here is, maybe this is a kind of argument for God. C.S. Lewis had an argument called Argument from Desire, and he just made an observation that we have desires, and the nature of a desire is that it is a wanting of something that could fulfill it. So we have a desire for food, and that means there is food to eat. We have a desire for drink, and there is liquid to sate our thirst. And there are all kinds of desires that have, at least in principle, the nature of a desire is that there's a fulfillment. However, he said, there are some desires that we have that are not fulfilled on this earth. Desire for justice, but justice isn't done, not completely and fully. And what Lewis said is the most obvious conclusion is that we were made for another world. There is another world where this desire will ultimately be satisfied. And incidentally, this argument from desire for Lewis is one of the biggest things that influenced him to become a Christian. And he writes about it very early in his Christian life. He writes a piece called Pilgrim's Regress? Is that his? Yeah, Pilgrim's Regress. And the story is all about this different ways he characterizes this haunting desire that is not fully fulfilled in this life. I traded on this quite a bit towards the end of the story of reality. But one of the most beautiful statements of Lewis in this regard, and I did include this towards the end, is he said, the door that we've been knocking on all of our lives will finally open. Well, that's cool. I wish I would have written that. That's really great, great. So since I didn't write it, but he did it, it was really cool. I still put it in my book, but I had to give him credit for it. The door that we've been knocking on all of our lives will finally open. And that's the final resurrection and that he's talking about, to glory. But notice there's this desire that points beyond us. That's the nature of that argument. That's how the great C.S. Lewis was profoundly moved towards Christianity. All I'm saying here with Thanksgiving, which we just had yesterday for most of you, and I'm waiting for 2 days from now, Thanksgiving entails the notion of gratitude, and gratitude is for something to someone. And there are things in this life that we are grateful for that no someone has provided in this life, that is, no human someone. But there is someone that is responsible, that points outside of this world. And just like Lewis's argument from desire, maybe this would be an argument from gratitude, the nature of gratitude. And the awareness that we have that we are given things to be grateful for that did not come from any human being. Well, it came from someone. And frankly, Thanksgiving is that time when we are not just thankful. Michael Shermer, did I hear him? I debated him once, but I don't think he said this in my debate with me, but I think in another debate with Dinesh D'Souza, I think. And he was talking about, well, you know, I'm just thankful. And he was trying to diminish thankfulness to something that could be done in isolation. Not thankful for, not thankful to, just thankful. Now, that made no sense to me. And I thought he in a certain sense, he was cheating a little bit. He wasn't really being intellectually honest because I went through the effort to demonstrate, I think, that kind of thing, gratitude, doesn't sit there in isolation. It's thankful for and thankful to. And I think he's missing something there. But, of course, he didn't want to say thankful to anyone outside the natural realm because he doesn't want to go there. He doesn't believe there is anyone there. So, in a sense, we are thankful for something but to no one. I guess a person could be, say, well, I'm glad that I am fortunate enough to have XYZ, but being glad that you're fortunate, lucky, is not the same as being thankful. That's all I'm saying. You're always thankful for, and you're thankful to. So, let me just look at my clock, see where I'm at. Do we have to take a break? I didn't have it open. Where is it? Oh. Yeah, why don't we take a break, and then I'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit more about something else on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All righty. We had a question here from Garrett in West Virginia. We lost Garrett. Maybe he just got tired of me pontificating about Thanksgiving. I don't know, which is understandable. Sometimes I go on a little bit long. But it's about the Old Testament and history. And I'm not sure if he's gone forever or if he's listening on a feed. And by the way, if you get the STR app, you can listen live to the show. I mean, literally, if you tune in at the right time, there is a live feed that you can listen to. And I remember I did that years and years ago when Jay Warner Wallace filled in for me for the first time. And when I listened to him for his first show, I said, this is a guy we got to get on board. And then I arm wrestled him into joining our team for a couple of years. And then he went off with doing great things after he left, so with his books, etc. But I was listening to the feed. So if you don't have our apps, they're easy to get. You go to the App Store and look up Stand to Reason, and there's two of them. There's the standard app with odds and ends, like the show and things that we've written in the blog and the Solid Ground and the mentoring letter and stuff like that. Then we have a quick reference app that has to do with particular topics like tactics or being an ambassador, or maybe the abortion question, where you can kind of work through outlines or quick, snappy kinds of answers to tough questions or something like that. I never use them myself, but that's because I wrote them and did them, and I don't want to listen to myself again. But you can use that. And so, I don't know, I'm carrying on here because I'm wondering if Garrett is still listening on his app. They might call back. But I have some other things to say, and if Garrett doesn't get back, I'll answer his question as best as I'm able with the information that I have. I wanted to say something else here about critique. So it doesn't happen all the time, but on occasion we get someone or a circumstance where a note or a letter or email might come in, where someone is offering us a critique. what I mean is generally they're dissatisfied with something we've said or an event we've had, and then they offer a critique of that event. And we got one recently that was quite thorough, about six pages, and most of it was things this person was dissatisfied with. And I'm not going to go into the details because that's not really my point. But I do want to talk about dealing with something like that. And it was an opportunity of instruction for our team, partly because it was a disheartening to get this letter when it pertained to an event that we had gotten tremendous feedback on and thought really went well. And then there was dissatisfaction in this individual with regards to particulars. Now, this person went into quite a bit of detail about the specific things that were not satisfactory. And so I'm sympathetic with the team at being a little disheartened by receiving this news. But I expressed to them that there's a couple of important things I wanted them to keep in mind, all right? And here's the first thing, and this is broad now. This isn't saying whether or not these concerns were legitimate. I'm not addressing that at the moment. I'm just a broad principle here. Here's the first one. Whenever you have something like that, you give a sermon, you give a conference, you give a speech, you give a course, someone's always going to be unhappy. That's just the fact of the matter. Some people are not going to like what you're doing. Some people are not going to even stay awake. So I fancy myself a fairly good communicator, and I still get people falling asleep on me, all right? Now, that's not fun. I don't like it, but it's the reality. You're never going to make everybody happy. It's just the way it is. So we should, part of us needs to accept that people are going to be disgruntled. Sometimes they're disgruntled for good reason, sometimes not. But I'm just setting that aside for the moment and saying there's always going to be somebody unhappy. I mean, if you have more than 10 people in the audience, you're going to get somebody that's not going to be thrilled about what you said, I suspect. First point. Second point, there will, and here's a qualifier, almost always be something useful in the criticism. There will almost always be something useful in the criticism. Now, for some of you, you might think, well, my wife or my husband or my kids or my this or my that, my that, whatever, and you want to write it off, or my boss. Well, it may be there's a lot of things that are inappropriate or said inappropriately, but behind the offensive element, there may be some truth. And we don't want to be like the fool. The fool hears reproof and either laughs or gets angry. Not a good thing. The wise person pays attention, all right? So there will almost always be something useful in the criticism, and our job is to eat the meat and throw away the bones. To cite a proverb of sorts. Eat the meat and throw away the bones. But we need to throw the bones away carefully, all right? Because not everything that initially looks like a bone is going to be a bone. There's this thing called confirmational bias that we all have, that we side with our own side, and we then have a kind of peculiar bias that causes us not to look carefully at things that disagree with our point of view or our take or our assessment of the circumstance. And this is hard to overcome. And this is why it's good to have some other people in the mix who can take a look at what's going on. A disinterested party, by the way, that's different from an uninterested party. An uninterested party has no, what's the word? I'm like, I was going to say it has no interest. An uninterested party is bored at what you're doing. They are showing a lack of attention to it. A disinterested party is someone who has no stake in the matter. So a judge and is supposed to, and juries are supposed to be disinterested, but they may be terribly interested in the details of the crime. They ought to be. But they are to make judgments in a disinterested way, not favoring one or the other inappropriately because they have no conflict of interest. In any event, you want to be careful that your own interests aren't getting away of the in the way of the assessment of the circumstances. Because a person who's accurately criticizing you is, in a sense, doing you a favor, even if they're not doing it in a virtuous way. Now, I cringe a little bit when I talk about this because I realize even in my own life, I know I don't like getting criticized. And I don't like owning up to what I need to own up to. But the fact is, people who are close to you in your life can see things that you can't see and can point things out, maybe inelegantly, that you don't want pointed out. Nevertheless, it may be the thing that you need to attend to. And so be careful when you throw away the bones. There may be some meat on those bones. The last thought that I offered to my team here as we're thinking about criticism is thank the person that offered the critique. Thank the person for the critique that was helpful or even meant to be helpful, and we're just being charitable here. Maybe somebody's just cranky. But let's just take them at face value. Applaud anything that you can. You know, there are some good insights here, you might say, if you believed that. And essentially just thank them for having the courage or the willingness to offer some things to you, and then you could say you'll give consideration to those things. Of course, you've got to give consideration to those things. You're not going to just say it. You're going to do it. All right. And then ask God whether there's something here. And maybe ask some others who are disinterested parties but have visibility of these things to see what they say. But in the response, in many cases, depending, but in many cases, it's not going to be helpful for you to make a defense. Tell the person where they're wrong and you're right. Now, sometimes, depending on the nature of the relationship, it may be valuable, but be careful. Because if they're fully convinced of their view and you're just reacting in a defensive way or appearing to do that, offering reasons why you think they're mistaken on certain points, they may just come back and reassert their claim. And now you're just back and forth. Yes, you are. No, you're not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Oh, well, that's unhelpful. Okay, so it might be better just say, hey, thank you. I appreciate it. And we'll take a look at it. And that's in the case I'm thinking of what we're going to do. And we've already begun doing too. So just something for you to think about. Is that Garrett? No, it isn't. We have a new caller coming up. Well, so hang on to Garrett because I'll maybe respond to Garrett in a minute. But, okay, let's see what we got here. Is there any whining on me, man? Things like, okay. All right, I'll take it. And this is, this is Cincinnati, Ohio. Is this either, is that Eli? Are you Eli?
Yes, so.
Pardon me?
He said, yes, sir.
Oh, okay, I see. So we have Christina and Eli, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good. Well, Eli, I'm so glad that you called me. Your mom helping you out a little bit?
Do you want to ask me a question? So Eli has asked me this question. Eli's 4 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have a good answer.
Okay.
So I said that you might be a good person to call.
Okay. All right. So
here he is. Oh, go for it.
All right, Eli, help me out. What's on your mind?
My God makes snakes, salt, and
what? Why did God make mosquitoes. Bad things?
Yeah.
Like mosquitoes?
Yeah, so.
Did you say like mosquitoes or snakes? Is that what you said?
Yeah, so. Oh.
Okay, so let me see if I got it right. Why did God make bad things like snakes and sharks and mosquitoes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, the one about mosquitoes is a question a lot of people have asked themselves, okay? And I can't tell you specifically about mosquitoes or even maybe about sharks, but let me give you an snakes I know something about, okay? And so the answer I give you regarding snakes may apply to other things too, even though we don't have insight. So do you know what snakes eat?
What?
Frogs? Well, oh, do you know what snakes eat?
What?
Snakes eat like mice. Snakes eat rats. Snakes eat a lot of annoying things. Okay, so if you have, I was talking to somebody recently, I promise you, this was just a week ago, and they said they had a snake in their garage, but they didn't bother it because the snake ate the mice. So is that a good thing or a bad thing if the snake eats the mouse?
Good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing, too. Of course, you and I are guys, so like that's kind of cool. Hey, go get them. Sometimes the moms are a little squeamish, but generally moms are glad with anything that takes care of the mice, all right? But notice how something that looks icky to us, like a snake, turns out to have a good purpose that God made it for. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I have some ideas about good purposes of snakes. I'm not so convinced about mosquitoes. Or let me put it this way. I don't know the good purpose of a mosquito. However, it might be that God knows more about mosquitoes and their value than I do. What do you think?
Good.
So all I'm suggesting is maybe God has a purpose for the mosquito that we don't know about, that similar to having purposes for snakes to eat, say, mice or something like that. Look at it. If there were no mosquitoes, then there wouldn't be any like companies selling mosquito repellent. Look at all the jobs that creates. There's just a thought. All right, Eli.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, sir.
That's good. Well, do you have any other questions that that has stumped your mom that I might be able to help you with? Well, maybe if you can think of another one later on, then you and your mom can give me a call back. How's that sound? Okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome, and you're welcome to come back sometime. I'm looking at a picture right now, Eli, of a family that the Blackmans, and they have JJ and Josh, who are now 16 years old and 18 years old. JJ's 18, Josh is 16. But they've been calling me for years and years. Oh, actually, this is 2 years ago, so they're older now still. But they called me when they were very young, kind of like you are, and they were, and every few months I'd get a call from them asking me a question. Now they're all grown up, and they know a lot because they listen to the show. Maybe you'll do that too. Okay, Eli?
Yes, sir. Okay.
All right. Are you looking forward to Thanksgiving?
Yes, sir.
What do you have on Thanksgiving dinner usually?
Turkey?
Uh-huh. All right. Well, that's standard. And does your mom make it or does your dad?
I don't know.
You don't know?
It just appears.
It just appears there, yeah. I'm sure it does. And mom and dad just appear exhausted at the end of the day. Well,
yes,
Christine,
sir.
Yes, ma'am. Christina, thank you for calling. And Eli, thank you for chatting with me. And maybe someday we'll talk again.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye. That's sweet. I once had a youngster many years ago call in. He must have been six. And this relationship lasted for 2 or 3 years. And I even had dinner at their home because they were a local Southern California family. And he asked me, what's a soul? And I thought, well, how am I going to explain this to the youngster? And I said, well, a soul is the invisible self. And the soul is, I said, do you ever go up to the snow? Which is what we say in Southern California. You go up to the snow in the mountains because, you know, we don't have snow down here. Got beaches. He said, yeah. I said, when you go up to the snow, does your mom ever put gloves on your hands? Yeah. I said, well, when your gloves are in your hands, can you see your hands? No. What do you see? The glove? Well, that's like your body. And think about your hands like the soul. And so the hands move the glove in the same way your soul moves the body. Oh, okay. I said, what happens when you take the hand out of the glove? It just lays there. That's right. That's what happens when you take the soul out of the body. It just lays there. Now, the difference is if you have your hand in the glove and you are always wearing gloves and never saw the hand, some people might wonder whether there was any hand there at all or it was just all glove. And that's the way people think about the soul. They just see the body. They don't see the soul in there moving the body, and so they think there is no soul. But that's a mistake. Anyway, that was the way the conversation went. I remember it all these years. It was fun. Kids can say the darndest things, or they can ask the darndest questions, but they're good questions oftentimes, so I'm glad to do that. Incidentally, this reminds me, and we're going to go to break here in just a second, but since we're coming, moving up on Christmas, it's what? 1 month from today when I'm broadcasting. Today's the 25th. That's scary. But when my 11-year-old was like six, she asked her older brother, who's about 25 years older than she is, and she asked him, what do you want for Christmas? He said, I just want some peace and quiet. She said, I ain't got none of that, which is right. All right, let's go to break a little bit more here. We'll only come back on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All right, final segment here on Stand to Reason. And let's see. I told you that I would answer Garrett's question, Garrett from West Virginia, though we lost him. So if Garrett listens to the podcast, which I suspect he does, then he'll get at least a partial answer. I only say partial because I have a partial question, meaning that when Amy puts the question up, she gives me basically the summary of it. And it may be that Garrett had more details that he wanted, and Amy's nodding her head, more details that he wanted me to pursue on this particular issue. So it has to do with the Old Testament's historicity. How do we know the Old Testament is truly history? Okay. Now, I just want to make an observation about the question, and that this is a question about historical reliability. It is not a question about inerrancy. Okay. Why do I make that distinction? Because these are two different claims. And therefore, there are two different approaches to that. So when we say the New Testament is historically accurate, for example, or the Old Testament in this case, we are saying that the history that is recorded is reliable. I just read a book about the Second World War. If the claim is that this is actual history, all it means is that the details, the salient details that are discussed there, are details of events that really took place the way they're described. We are not claiming that every jot and tittle is perfect. We don't require that kind of perfection in order to sustain the claim of historical accuracy for a document. That every jot and tittle is perfect and without error is a different kind of claim. And for me as a Christian, of course, I hold the view that the Bible is without error, but this is not a view that I'm interested in debating with a non-Christian, because I think this is an inside discussion on the nature of revelation. And I don't need an inerrant Bible, Old or New Testament, in order to make the case that the view of the Bible, the worldview, and the salient details, the claims about God and Jesus and salvation and sin, etc., are true. I don't need inerrancy to make that case. I believe in inerrancy, but I don't need it. Think of all the books that are written by Christians about the Christian worldview. None of those books claims to be inerrant, but they each claim to be sound, true, insofar as they reflect an accurate understanding of the world. Now, whether or not they're true is not my point. That's another question. But the point I'm making is you can still have true stuff without having inerrant stuff, every jot and tittle. And so this is a question not about inerrancy. And so therefore, contradictions that might be raised, many of them are really irrelevant, because the only role that the contradictions play generally in the discussion is whether or not the Bible is inspired by God. And if it's inspired by God, there wouldn't be any errors like contradictions. And if there are real contradictions, then it's not inspired. And I think there's a kind of a point there. But there could be contradictions in genuinely sound, reliable historical evidence. There may be details of one witness to an event that doesn't jibe completely with the details of another person who witnessed the same event. That doesn't mean the event didn't take place. It means someone is mistaken about it. That's all it means. If there is a genuine contradiction, a lot of the alleged contradictions of Scripture are not contradictions at all. They are just different perspectives. Gadarene demoniac, was there one or two? Well, there was two. But one account only focuses in on an individual, not on the both. And so you have a varying account from a different perspective. You don't have a contradictory account, because the account with one didn't say one and only one and not two. By the way, this is a common way that we talk when we describe events and things that happen. We sometimes isolate individuals and focus in on that, or particulars. So those aren't contradictions. The issue here, though, is simply historical reliability. And so when someone is going to ask the question, how can we know the Old Testament is truly history? I'm going to ask the question in response, how can we know anything is truly history, especially ancient history, which is what we're talking about with the Bible? And the answer is varied. I mean, some people might say, and these are the more skeptical, we can't know anything about ancient history. Now, that's not the received point of view. That's not the conventional wisdom of historians, or else they'd be out of a job, particularly if their historical period is long ago. No, they would say we can know with a very high degree of certainty particulars about ancient history, and we can know that because there are certain evidences in place that allows us to be confident of these events. What kind of evidence would that be? Well, one of it would be a written document. documents of some sort that survived the period are evidence of particulars about that period. Now, we have to ask the question, and they have to be alert, is this an accurate account? Is there exaggeration or whatever? But generally speaking, if you find a document about an ancient event, there's a lot of credibility given to that document. Now, if there's corroboration from something else, well, that's even better. If you have multiple documents. Now, it might be that you don't have the original document. When you have a stone with stuff etched into it, that's probably original. When you have parchments, parchments decay. They break up. They fall off, apart. And so this is why people copy parchments, and you have families of manuscripts then that can be used to compare with each other. But these are also important details. So when it comes to things that happen in the Old Testament, we have copies of accounts that appear to have been, go way back, and give us information. And by the way, it's not just the Old Testament, it's other ancient history too. Sometimes these are inscribed in stone things. I think they're called steles. Is that how you pronounce that? Steles? It looks like steel, but I think it's stele. In any event, you have these artifacts that have information on them. And so one of the things, I was in Caesarea Philippi about 4 weeks ago now. Not Philippi, Caesarea, which is right on the Mediterranean. And in this town, famously, they found the Pilate stone. Now, we had known about Pilate from manuscripts of the New Testament and the execution of Jesus of Nazareth, but now we have a stone with his name on it that verifies or authenticates, corroborates what is in the written thing. So you can have confidence of historical events because you have evidence they took place, and the evidence takes different forms. It might be written material. It might be corroboration from archaeology and geography, okay? So this is how you attest these things back and forth. One of the interesting things about, say, Israel is you have a collection of documents of a historical nature. In other words, it tells things that took place. All right. Gee, is it telling the truth? Is it accurate? Well, let's go back to the land and dig around a little bit. And it turns out that so many of the things that are spoken of match archaeological evidence regarding those things. You can dig them up and find out, well, here's the thing that was spoken of in that event. When I was in Israel, they talked about some recent find. Of a seal. A seal is like an object that you press into wax that authenticates that the document that is waxed close comes from the court official or whatever that wrote the document. Okay, so this is a way, in a contemporary situation where I write this thing, I'm the king, and poof, there's my seal that authenticates the document. So there is an account of some official putting a seal on the document. This is in Chronicles or Kings. This is a long time ago. This is hundreds of years before the birth of Christ when this event allegedly took place. You read about it there in the Hebrew text. Well, it turns out that they dug that sucker up. They dug up the seal with the guy's name on it that matched the account of the Old Testament. Do you think that gives some validity to the account in the Hebrew Scriptures? Of course it does. So this is the way they figure things out. And if you've got an account that is broadly cross-referenced in a couple of different ways as being reliable, this lends credibility to the entire document. Now, there are different schools of thought on how to deal with. Is that next week? Oh, okay. Next week we have an interview with Stephen Meyer and someone else. Amy's looking it up. Okay. Tatis Kennedy. Okay, we have two, and they're going to be talking about the Exodus account. I didn't realize that was next weekend. So these details will come up a little bit more, in a little bit more detail about a particular event in the Old Testament about the Exodus, because this is one that seems not well attested to in archaeology, though we have this strong statement in the Hebrew Scriptures. But the point I'm making is the more that you have all of these things kind of dovetailing together, the more touchstones you have of verification of an account, the more credibility it gives to the rest of the account, which doesn't have affirmation in independent sources. Now, I mentioned that there are two different schools of thought here. You have what are called the biblical minimalists, and then you have those, I don't actually know what they're called. They're not called maximalists, but they're the other group. The biblical minimalists have this point of view that if you read it in the Bible, you can't trust it. In other words, the Bible, the biblical record, is not on its own a reliable source. Now, they don't treat other written records like that. When they find other written records, they deal with them as voices from the past regarding an event. But the biblical record is always always in doubt, in question. They're skeptical about it unless there is corroborating evidence. And then the corroborating evidence is the thing that has weight, and the biblical record just got lucky. All right, something like that. Those are the minimalists. Then you have the other side, whatever they're called, who are willing to take the biblical record as a voice. This is one voice. Now, if we can get more corroboration, that's even better, but we have to take seriously the voice of the ancient scriptures regarding the Hebrews, that it does tell us, or at least potentially tell us something accurately about that ancient world. So those are the ways of looking at it. The simple answer to the question, how do we know the Old Testament is truly history, is that it's satisfied, pardon me, to the degree we have confidence in the history of the Old Testament, it's based on the kinds of things that we just talked about, that there are ancient records, and the Old Testament is an example of an ancient record. If you're a minimalist, you're not going to take that seriously. However, there are other ways of corroborating, and generally the corroboration is coming from some other artifact from the ancient world, either something written or something that bears witness to the accuracy or the testimony in the Hebrew Scriptures, or you're going to have some location that is excavated that ties into some particular account in the Hebrew Scriptures. It all kind of goes together, all right? And it's a bit of an imprecise science, if science is even the right word. But it's not a guess. It's not just a crapshoot. And if you go to the Holy Land, you're going to see, or even just Google it, you're going to see digs all over the place. And we went to view some magnificent things when we were there maybe 3 weeks ago. We viewed tremendous archaeological locations where you see all kinds of corroboration between the testaments, whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, and what, once the dig is excavated, what we actually find. Now, sometimes there are controversies. The walls of Jericho, did they fall in or did they fall out? And there was some early testimony that contradicted the biblical account, but then there are other ways of understanding that as well. And so there's kind of back and forth about some of that. But characteristically, you find all kinds of things in the Middle East that fit hand in glove with the biblical account. So anyway, that's my answer to Garrett, and I know there's a lot more that he probably had in mind, but that's a good note to close on here. maybe a minute or two early, but I don't have a minute or two more to talk about on this particular question. Glad to be part of your spiritual life, or maybe non-spiritual life, as the case may be. And hope what I've offered gets you thinking about the important things. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.